sea of space, the stars are others. We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week's wine is about responsibility to protect. Much of the world has been stunned by the current civil war in Iraq. Okay, most have yet to call it that, but that's what it is. You have the Sunnis on the one side who are attempting to regain some status in the nation that they formerly held with an iron fist under the Saddam regime, and the Shiites who currently rule the country with a tinfoil hand, more corrupt and pretty biased. In the light of a video showing mass executions of soldiers and civilians, the world finds itself again in the awkward situation of decrying the violence while sitting back and doing nothing. The dilemma is even worse for the U.S., who has had calls for direct military intervention from the Iraqi government. It has come to the point where the U.S. have had on and off talks with Iran, yes, axes of evil Iran, about what can be done to help settle things in Iraq. Now on the show many times before, I have said that the world, via the UN, has a right to protect innocent civilians who are being targeted by their own government. I would, in this case, extend that to anyone who causes violence against a passive population, as seems to be the case in Iraq. One could argue this was not the case in Syria, just to sort of provide a bit of contrast, where you actually had a popular uprising. Although civilians always seem to face the brunt of the violence, I would argue that this may be another case where we might support military intervention in the name of peacekeeping. Well, maybe peacemaking is a better term considering the recent history in Iraq. Now, some will argue that we should not interfere in the internal affairs of a nation. What right do we, however we define the we, what right do we have to pick the winner or loser? Because, or so the argument goes, whatever side you help, the rebels against the Assad government or Maliki government against the rebels in Iraq, you're thwarting self-determination. I would reject the idea that we would have to pick a side. The whole premise of peacekeeping is to stand between belligerents in an impartial way. The sides can still promote their positions, but they no longer have the avenue of violence to force the nation to their side. I would also argue that there are times that, even if you upset a balance, that may be preferable to allowing the slaughter of hundreds to thousands of civilians. So let's return to Iraq. We should take a moment and provide a bit of history to the current situation. Many have argued that Iraq is a made-up nation, that unlike Egypt, Iran, etc., there are no Iraqi people. Iraq, under Muslim rule, i.e. Ottomans and Mamluks, divided the nation into three parts, which coincides with what has been referred to as Kurdistan in the north, Shiistan in the south, and Sunnistan in the middle, but always ruled by a central power, be it in Baghdad under the Mamluks or Istanbul under the Ottomans. After World War I, the land became part of the British Protectorate. This is when oil exploitation by the West really got started. The Kingdom of Iraq was created when the British installed Amir Fazl as king in 1932. Side note, Fazl apparently can thank T.C. Lawrence, i.e. Lawrence of Arabia, for getting the gig. Although semi-autonomous, it was very much under the thumb of the UK and later the US. In 1945, a strong Kurdish revolt started at about the same time Iraq joined the UN. Thanks to growing economic instability, wars with Israel, British protectionism in Kuwait, increased reliance on oppression to maintain control, and the rise of Nasser in Egypt and the Pan-Arab movement, the army overthrew the monarchy in 1958. There was much political turmoil in Iraq during the 60s, and it was only after the consolidation of the Ba'ath Party that Iraq achieved a kind of golden age in the 70s. In 1979, Saddam was chosen as successor to the retiring president. He actually set up the first parliament in Iraq since the fall of the monarchy in 58. He is also credited with much of the modernization of Iraq during the 70s. Alas, Iraq never had a solid southern border. Under the Ottomans, all of Kuwait and parts of northern Iran were part of the southern Iraqi province of Basra. Many times since independence, Iraq has claimed Kuwait and has had skirmishes with Iran on territorial disputes. Border tension eventually led Iraq to all-out war with Iran in 1980, with the support of the U.S. and its blessings. Then, the 1990 annexation of Kuwait happened, in spite of U.S. opposition, which led to the first Gulf War. Then, after a decade of sanctions and the ruin of Iraq, Bush Jr. thought about time to eliminate Saddam, and we get Gulf War II. Having completely destroyed the nation, removed the entire pre-existing governmental system, Iraq fell into a quasi-civil war, which was only suppressed with heavy U.S. military support. Once the U.S. withdrawed all but a token military force at the end of 2010, after 36 months of apparent recovery to normal nationhood, well, it seems we're back to civil war. I mentioned that there are three broadly speaking groups involved. The war is really between the Sunni and the Shiites. The Kurds in the north have enjoyed semi-autonomy since the Kurdish-Iraq War of 1972, with a lot of ups and downs, but currently they are the only force that can help stabilize the region. And because they have never had more independence than they have right now, they do kind of prefer the status quo, Shiite dominance, although they're no fans of either group. So back to the present. Should the U.S. step in and halt, if not reverse, the insurgency while simultaneously forcing the Iraqi government to play fair with its Sunni minority? Should they actually deliver what they promised prior to invasion, democracy and peace? Yes and no. It might be the right thing to do because of the UN Principle of Responsibility to Protect, which roughly states that if a nation's population are suffering war crimes, the international community has the right to intervene to halt these crimes. Now, I will concede that it's hard to know when an official war crime has been committed, but I think Iraq, and sadly many other regions in the world, think Congo, Burma, Sri Lanka, that intervention should have occurred to protect the people, victims who are not only citizens of the nation, but also citizens of the world. And to reiterate, this involvement should be of the peacekeeping kind, where troops remove violence as a means of political debate. Once again, back to Iraq. Beyond the responsibility to protect, the U.S. has a second moral obligation to assist, and that is Colin Powell's famous remarks prior to the U.S. invasion, the Pottery Barn Rule. If you break it, you own it. There's no doubt that the U.S. broke Iraq, and well, the tape they used to rebuild it seems to be failing. So because the U.S. has direct and indirect culpability for creating the conditions that have facilitated this crisis to arise, they should put troops on the ground. Beyond the fact that there is next to no support for this option, and the U.S. government has said that they do not want to be the Iraqi Air Force, they can't really do anything. The war in Iraq has been such a debacle that it is likely to overtake Vietnam as the worst war in U.S. history. And let us not forget the Coalition of the Willing. That's UK, Australia, South Korea, Italy, Poland. And these are only the countries that supplied more than 2,500 troops. Over 40 nations sent troops, including two from Iceland. Iceland? Thankfully, Canada was not part of this farce. When you couple this with NATO's over-response to Libya, where their duty to protect became regime change, and the under-response to Syria, well, adding to U.S. issues is its use of drones in nations such as Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, and other places. Well, it's hard to think that any U.S. involvement would be unbiased. The foundation of many of the complaints about intervention revolve around the idea of its not peacekeeping but imperialism, which has been validated by the U.S. on many occasions. So my line is not about the failure to help the people of Iraq or Syria or the Central African Republic, as sad as that may be. It is to weep that upon the arrival of a milestone of global humanity, the acknowledgement that citizens of the globe, regardless of nations, have a fundamental right to life, and it is the global village's responsibility to protect that right. In the long march of history, we are at last applying ethical rules on a global scale, as we've done economic rules for centuries. And I shed a tear of joy for that. And yet, having evolved to this point, we have executed this principle in such a poor manner that it is likely to be relegated to the land of the theoretical, a right in name only. And for that, that is to weep for all humanity. We'll be right back after this break.
The federal government is trying to ram through a set of electronic surveillance laws that will invade your privacy and cost you money. The plan is to force every phone and internet provider to surrender our personal information to authorities without a warrant. The worst part of their invasive, all-encompassing surveillance scheme is that you have to pay for it out of your own pocket. Send Ottawa a message by signing the petition at stopspying.ca. That's www.stopspying.ca. Thank you.
And we're back. Just when you thought it was safe to go to the brothel, the Harper government strikes again. Canada may once again do something that will make it unique in the world. We're about to enact a law that will make it legal to sell a product while simultaneously making it illegal to buy. Institutionalized state-sponsored entrapment. What is the product? Sex services, aka prostitution. This law is in response to the Supreme Court striking down a previous law on the topic. To refresh our listeners, About that ruling, let's reminisce. The applicants, the people who challenged the law, were arguing that several laws violated their Charter of Rights. The respondent, the government wanting to uphold the law, argued that it could limit the rights based on Section 1 of the Charter, which states, the Charter of Rights and Freedoms guarantees the rights and freedoms set out in it subject only to such reasonable limits prescribed by law as can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. The court, in testing to see if the limitation is valid, uses what is called the Oaks test, named after the case where it was first heard. The first test holds that there must be a, quote, pressing and substantial objective. For example, the desire to protect minorities from hate speech. If the court agrees that there is a suitable objective, the Crown then must show proportionality. Proportionality is actually three things. First, the restriction in question must be related to achieving the objective. For example, preventing someone from driving because they're a shoplifter, there's no rational connection between the two. Whereas preventing someone from driving who's an alcoholic might be a stronger case. Second, it must be as minimal as possible. For example, a rehabilitated, i.e. lawfully released from prison, child sex offender could be prohibited from going into any public park. But that's a large limitation. A more minimal limitation would be prohibiting them from school areas. This achieves the law's objective while not being too onerous on the charter. Lastly, it must be proportional to the objective. For example, the objective of stopping jaywalking, a minor offense, should have an equally minor limitation on rights, whereas stopping hate speech, a major offense, could support a greater limitation on rights. Okay, now that you have a brief understanding of the Charter, let's just say the court did not believe these laws deserve Section 1 protection and thus struck them down. The laws in question were, 1. Anyone who keeps a common body house, a place that is kept for the purpose of prostitution or the practice of acts of, quote, indecency, is guilty of indictable offense. This extends to the, quote, inmates, i.e. workers, landlords, and anyone found without lawful excuse, who are to be liable to summary convictions. 2. Everyone who lives wholly or in part on the avails of prostitution of another person. 3. Every person who, in a public place or in any place open to public view, attempts to communicate for the purpose of engaging in prostitution or obtaining the sexual services of a prostitute is punishable by a summary conviction. These laws were, in a way, quite strange. I can understand if you were left with the impression prostitution itself was illegal in Canada, yet it's not. Prostitution itself is legal in Canada. They have just written the law so that you can't actually practice it. Well, above board. So in response to this ruling, the Harper government has introduced legislation that will reverse the wording of the law while ensuring that nothing actually changes, that the environment for prostitution remains as dangerous as before. What's in the law? It will ban the selling of sex anywhere that people under 18 are found. This is pretty broad. It should be noted that, well, kids can really go everywhere. Okay, maybe not bars or adult bookstores. And you might say that's good. Treat the sex trade like liquor stores. That would be progressive. But the Conservative Party jettisoned their progressiveness a decade ago. I think that we can all agree that you don't want sex workers hanging out in the schoolyard. Teenagers might argue with this, but for the most part, we can agree that the sex trade should be treated like alcohol or some cigarettes. Also in the bill, police would be given a new power to search for and seize advertising material for the sale of sex, a provision that could be used to raid escort services, which now operate virtually in the open. Let me state that again. It will make it illegal to advertise sexual services. Right now, if you look at the classified section of most, quote, street papers, the ones you get for free, sort of the Georgia Strait, the Extra, well, sex works are plainly visible plying their trade like any other business people. Under this law, that would be illegal. In fact, the law would put sex worker advertisements in the same category as child porn and snuff vids. Side note, I discovered that voyeuristic recordings are also classified as the same as child pornography and, once again, snuff films. That is, if you videotape your kids or a friend's kid, no sex involved, then sell that vid, you could be arrested. I understand the intent of this idea, but what if I'm selling a vid of a local soccer team, wrestling team, swim team? It also makes distribution a crime, irrespective of the exchange of money. So if someone takes a vid of their kid winning at some of the mentioned events, then sends it out, like a proud parent might, to friends or family, they could be charged. And getting back to banning advertising, something that has been de facto legal. This law, at least in this regards, is more regressive than the one it is trying to replace. In fact, much of legislation seems obsessed with sex worker advertisement. But of course, this law has nothing to do with helping women or sex workers, many of whom are men, but in promoting an ideological Christian morality. More on that later. The law has potential jail sentences for up to 5 years for sex workers who advertise, and the people who take their advertisements. By making advertising of sex work illegal, this will make it impossible for these people to work in the relative safety of their homes, severely limiting their ability to vet prospective clients. Basically, it will force the sex workers onto the streets to ply their trade. If women's safety were the real point of this, then why is this part of the bill? It is basically pointing a legal gun to those people who have found a safe way to practice their trade. But of course, it is a gun the government wants to use, not to make their lives safer, but to dictate a narrow-minded Christian ethic that plays so well to the conservative base. One might get the impression that election is on the horizon. Previously, the struck down law tried to criminalize the sale of sex. This law reverses that by criminalizing the buying of sex, with steep fines to jail sentences of up to 5 years. The government line is that it is trying to send a message to Johns that buying sex is not only wrong, but now a crime. Sex workers do not want their clients arrested for trying to purchase sexual services. They do want their clients arrested when they are violent, abusive, or exploitative. Pimping is still a crime, but the hiring of accountants and bodyguards would be allowed. It also seems to excuse the partners, lifetime partners, i.e. spouses, legal or technical, from being convicted. This may be a perverse outcome of having real pimps, the cartoon villainy types, forcing their whore to marry them so as to protect their profit margin. It apparently does not apply to a person who receives the benefit, i.e. money or goods, in the context of a legitimate living arrangement with the person from whose sexual services the benefit is derived. That said, I may have misinterpreted the text. It could also mean if you pay your wife for sex, you will not be convicted. The line itself states this, and I'm going to point out right here, if some of these wordings seem a bit odd, I'm trying to lift as much from the original text of the law as I can, so forgive some of the bad grammar and oddly sounding phrases. But going back, one of the lines in the law states, a person who engages in conduct in relations to any person that would constitute an offense under section 286.3, i.e. sex for money, is exempt if the context of a legitimate living arrangement with that person from whose sexual service the benefit is derived. And I think benefit refers to money or goods, and services are, well, you know, wink wink, nudge nudge, say no more, say no more. They roll back some of these exceptions when they add another line that states, no exception for those who receive the benefit in the context of a commercial enterprise that offers sexual services for consideration. So if you in any way help your partner ply their trade, you can no longer expect to be exempt from the law. This would also, I think, rule out any kind of sort of sex worker cooperative. Two things that have been shown to make sex work safer. Now it's important to define what a pimp is under this law. Everyone who receives a financial or other material benefit, knowing that it is obtained by or derived directly or indirectly from sexual services. So under the old law, sex workers had to find dark places for fear of arrest if they conducted business in the light. You see, if a sex worker wanted to set up shop, they can't rent a store or even a hotel room. Why? Well, if the owner of the place knows, they automatically become the pimp. Similarly, if they wanted to hire someone to do background checks on prospective clients, well, those people too become pimps. This law makes little to no change to this problem. Yes, they can hire a bodyguard, but not a room to ply their trade. They can hire an accountant, but they can't place an ad or even have someone screen clients. You cannot solicit in public. The law states, everyone is guilty of an offense who, in a public place or in public view, for the purposes of offering or providing sexual services. So let's recap. The law will prevent you from renting a place to do your work. You cannot advertise your services. You can't even do the old classic street walk, at least in open places. So what else is there? As a result of this law, street-based sex work will be the target of law enforcement and can be arrested. they will be displaced into dangerous and isolated parts of the city where they are more likely to work alone in order to avoid police detection. Sex workers will rush to get into vehicles without taking the time to screen clients and negotiate the terms of the transaction, resulting in much greater risk of harm. Sex workers will also face barriers to police protection as a result of their criminalization. This law is not intended to make sex workers' life safer, but, if I may channel Harper, to punish them for the immoral whores they are. The government's claim they are only concerned with women in danger is not only hypocritical, loathsome, repulsive, but it's an obscene act of deceit. They will have to once again go to these dark places because that is where their clientele will be for fear of arrest. Because, let's recap. The government would ban indecent activity rather than sex in body houses. What is indecent? Well, in the immoral words of the U.S. Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. That's the angst for you. In Canada, well, we're different. According to R.V. LeBay, in Canadian law, morality has no place in determining whether these activities were indecent. According to Canadian law, we use an objective standard which is concerned with whether any harm is being done. Put in another way, indecency in Canadian law is something that threatens someone's liberty, exposes something undesirable to people, forces someone to commit a misdeed, or harms someone engaged in certain acts. The court said the threshold for harm should be set high, that some things that certain Canadians will not like should be allowed to exist unless it becomes so serious it threatens the society. In anticipation of a constitutional challenge, the government rewrote the law's purpose in a way that judges hearing any future constitutional challenge would need to keep in mind, promoting human dignity and equality and protecting children and communities. Here we start to see the hidden message in the law. First, I can't help but note that much of legislation is redundant. We have laws already about child prostitution, child labor, slave labor, be it sex workers or sweatshop. There's a joke in there somewhere, but I'll reframe. The topic's kind of too serious. Other parts are just ideological. Why can I be harassed by people trying to sell phones on the street, or worse, Jesus in his many disguises? But if I want a hand job, I've got to ask it in code or go into some dark place like where I buy my pot. It's already illegal to do it in public. So what harm is there? And once again, Harper's imposing minimum sentences, taking away the discretion of judges, and just being an ass. Minimum sentences are punitive and vengeful and have no place in a civilized society, which perhaps tells you the direction Harper hopes to take this great nation. If you drug a person to have sex, or get them to have sex with others, well, the drugging part is already a crime, and sex without consent, i.e. under the influence, is also a crime. Sex with minors? It's a crime. Forcing someone to do anything, be it sex or sewing, is slavery, and that is already illegal. They go to great pains to ensure that the providers of these services, the prostitutes themselves, are exempt from most of the convictions. That is, if a person places an ad to sell sex, they are immune to prosecution, even though the paper that runs the ad and the person responding to the ad are all up for jail time. This is almost the opposite of our attitude towards drugs, mostly pot, that we should make it not criminal to buy a joint, but illegal to sell one. Justice Minister Peter McKay states, quote, "Today our government is making prostitution illegal for the first time. We are criminalizing the purchase of sexual services and in very specific instances the sale, in areas where young people under the age of 18 could be present." Okay, so that's the law. But the elephant in the room, I think, is sexism or misogyny. It is men telling women that what they do is immoral and that needs to end. Peter McKay said it overtly, and I am sure unintentionally, when he said the bill recognizes that the vast majority of those who sell sexual services do not do so by choice. We view the vast majority of those involved in selling sexual services as victims. Women as victims. Where have I heard that one before? Oh my, women are weak and they need a man like Peter McKay to save them from their life choices. As already said, things like trafficking of workers, be they sex slaves or factory slaves, is already illegal. And last time I went to high school, trying to have sex with a minor was still illegal. The only good thing about the bill is the $20 million that is provided to help those people who are sex workers out of necessity. If only they could find that kind of money for people who work at McDonald's because they have to, or those who have to clean the shit out of Peter McKay's cabin outhouse. The result of an online consultation that showed two-thirds of more than 31,000 respondents said selling sex should not be an offense. But remember, the trick Harper is playing is not to criminalize the sale, but the advertisement and purchase of sex. Katrina Pacey, a lawyer for Pivot Legal Society, said, "This is in fact full criminalization of prostitution, which is going to result in sex workers going to jail. But that's okay. They're only immoral sinners doomed to hell." Oops, sorry about that. I'm channeling Harper again. Well, let's be fair. Harper's not a moral person. What I am channeling is the constituency base he's hoping to solidify for the next election. McKay said, "No model that involved full decriminalization or legalization will ever make prostitution a safe endeavor. The real problem is misogyny. Every time I hear that prostitution or pornography is an evil, it's because it objectifies women, it demeans women. Well, no, it does not. Not any more than we have women nannies or women housekeepers. It's not the profession, but the gender that we seem to have a problem with." Let me clarify. Women do get objectified, and female pornography is a salient example of this. But let's not confuse cause with effect. One could argue mothers are objectified because they are not seen as individuals in their own right, but just someone who cleans the house, feeds the kids, and warms the bed. The real issue is sexism and misogyny. Nowhere in the bill is this addressed. Now, they do make a valuable point. Not everyone works in the profession for the love of the job. Sometimes they do so because that is the only job that they can get that provides food and shelter. And no one wants to have people be slaves to the job, be it sex work, McDonald's, or cleaning McKay's cabin crapper. So the provision of $20 million for sex workers to find different work is a good thing. But again, it does not address the real issue, poverty, racism, sexism. If they want to provide money for people who want to escape unwanted professions, well, that should apply equally to the fry flinger, the toilet cleaner, and, if they wish a different job, the prostitute. As a guy, there is nothing this law is addressing, at least logically or morally, if I want to get it on with a chick or a dude and have them pay me money. Well, that seems okay. After all, I'm a man, and I have dominion over my body. But if I'm a weaker, more exploited female, well, then my consensual sex is an act of oppression. The irony is the attitude of oppression, that women cannot control their lives, that they need special protection. Every time I hear that porn degrades women, I have to ask, what about gay porn? Okay, on one level, it is instrumental, but the objectification argument is incoherent. If I watch gay porn, am I objectifying myself? Am I no longer me, but it? It makes no sense in and of itself, nor do I think that the performers see themselves as objects any more than a model, an athlete, or a singer. That said, and I feel I must repeat this point, women are treated as objects. It has nothing to do with sex, pornography, or sex work in and of themselves, but how these professions are allowed to be practiced. It's like saying that slaves were abused while picking cotton, so we should outlaw cotton. That gets at the symptom, but not the root cause. You see, there is an irony here. The conservatives, be they Harper or your local pastor, they want to save women from the harms of prostitution. Yet those harms arise because of the moral and legal constraints that are placed upon the profession. At one time, alcohol was deemed immoral and was outlawed in the USA. That very criticism made it an even greater evil than they claimed that it was. No longer was there food and safety oversight to ensure that the product was safe for human consumption. You could no longer go to your local pub to have a pint. Now you had to go to some back alley dive. And worst of all, you no longer had law-abiding, tax-paying businesses, but criminal organizations that ensured market dominance not via advertising, but the end of a gun. Prohibition made these mobsters billionaires. It is the moral drive to criminalize normal behavior that can turn that activity into the detriment they fear. Ultimately, this law will, and let me say this with emphasis, will be repealed by the Supreme Court because it perpetuates all the harms while continuing the stigmatization of the trade. This, like Harper's hyper support for Israel and the new west-facing Ukraine, a simple but obvious and immoral play for a key demographic. Harper is always thinking about the next election and how he can manipulate it for his aims. The nation of Canada be damned. His will, his ego, is sacrosanct. 2015, never forget. We'll be right back after this break.
Science is the best tool ever devised. subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com.
And we're back. Okay, I did a bad thing in that last segment. I asserted that prostitution, i.e. sex work, was not innately harmful. To be a true Scotsman, I think I should provide some support for this claim. Largely, what is at the heart of the matter is brothels, bawdy houses. Should they be legal and above board, or remain illegal in the hands of criminals? Okay, sorry, that's kind of a loaded statement. Let's rephrase it. Should the law accept the legal existence of brothels? Note, I'm making a distinction between prostitution and brothels. Why? Well, as all sides have proclaimed, selling sex itself is not illegal. It is the manner and location of said transactions that are subject to scrutiny. So I shall at times conflate sex work and work location as the same issue. So again, I ask, should we legalize whorehouses? Let's take our skeptical mind and examine what the evidence is out there on the issue. In evidence to the Supreme Court challenge that struck down the previous law on sex work, a number of former and current workers stated that it was their experience that work indoors was significantly safer than walking the streets. Most stated that they entered into the line of work without coercion beyond the capital system, i.e. that they needed money. The state offered counter-evidence, but it focused mostly on abusive pimps who were violent both indoors and on the street. This, though, is what a skeptic called anecdotal evidence, so not much weight either way. Law enforcement witnesses stated that most of the harm hovered around drug and alcohol abuse and organized crime. They saw the workers as victims of both the pimps and the Johns, noting most prostitutes are poor while the Johns come from all walks of life, a reoccurring theme in the respondent's submission. And most critics of protection is the view that sex trade workers are victims of other circumstances and substance addiction. Law enforcement witnesses also expressed frustration at attempts to enforce these laws. In 2008, 2,377 charges were made for brothels, but only 131 convictions. Under cross-examination, they all stated that streets were worse for violence than indoors, that indoor locations could be set up to reduce the chances and levels of violence. Again, largely anecdotal, but it did corroborate the claim that indoor work is safer than streetwalking. I ignore the convictions data. Regardless of whether a law is easily enforced or not, doesn't make it a good law, or a bad one. It's hard to fly. That doesn't make flight bad. The Fraser Report in 1985 held that prostitutes should be allowed to conduct their business in private however they choose, including the disposition of their fees for service. They also stated that although there is a strong perception of a connection between prostitution and drug abuse, the evidence shows that it is actually only a small part of the business and not typical. It also reiterated the fact streetwalking is far more dangerous. They also reported, after extensive cross-country consultation with the public, there was no consensus on the issue. The Fraser Report did recommend the removal of laws constraining non-nuisance street solicitation, that laws against living on the avails of prostitution be reworded so as to criminalize abusive behavior of pimps and not actual financial relationships, and to allow prostitutes to legally work from home. That's an important point to make, and again, the new law ignores. Most of the harm is not in the management, pimping of sex workers, but the physical or psychological abuse, things that are already illegal. If I went to work tomorrow, and my boss smacked me around for not selling enough chocolate, well, I could call the cops, and the situation would be resolved. However, if my job was somehow criminalized, i.e. the selling of chocolate on the streets or advertising it or something, well, I'm unlikely to report the crime because I may get caught up and charged myself. This is what sex trade workers face now with the moralized law being presented to Parliament. In 1995, the Calgary-Winnipeg study reported that due to the criminalization of the communication for the purposes of prostitution, workers were forced to work in more remote and isolated areas, making them more vulnerable to violence. the laws do not suppress prostitution, but simply drive it further underground. So the research into the issue seems to point to support for striking down of the old law and the condemnation of the proposed new law. But what about experimental evidence? This can be found by looking at the effects prostitution has in other countries. Legalization in Holland, although debated, according to reports commissioned by the Dutch government, has seen moderate success in improving working conditions for prostitutes, including notably a significant reduction in sexually transmitted diseases. In 2003, New Zealand legalized and regulated brothels, the result being significant reductions in violence, coercion, and theft in the in-house workers. Street workers, though, still suffered. Germany passed its law in 2002 with the explicit purpose of removing prostitution as a breeding ground for crime. Nevada has several regulations to help protect women, such as negotiated prices up front, with management listening in to ensure the proper behavior of the client, the fee paid in advance, with the worker given an opportunity to express reservations away from the client. Each room has a panic button, and there's no, quote, quick exit for Johns. Clients are not allowed to be anonymous, discouraging them doing harm and ensuring that if they do, they will be apprehended and prosecuted. So the rational trend seems to be getting sex trade workers off the street reduces their risk, these being violence, theft, and coercion. Bucking the trend, Sweden criminalized the buying of sex and pimping. The, quote, Act on Violence Against Women, 1999. To understand why Sweden has gone against the grain, we only need to look at the act's name. It is not an anti-prostitution act, but an act intended to, quote, defend women. It seems to ignore the fact that a significant number of sex trade workers are men. Many, both pro and con of the new law, say it is in the Nordic tradition, even if McKay says it's a made-in-Canada law, like a table maybe made from IKEA. There is a constant assertion that sex trade workers are always victims, even when they are voluntary participants, that they need someone, usually the male minister of state, to protect them from other bad men. The case at hand was not prostitution, but brothels. Strawman, refuting a position by substituting a superficially similar yet unequivalent proposition and refuting it, without ever having actually refuted the original position. This is a strawman because it ignores the argument, are prostitutes safer in legal or illegal brothels, and instead argues prostitution is innately wrong slash harmful, therefore prostitutes are safer in illegal brothels. I'm just stunned by the logic. Okay, to be fair to the anti-sex worker side, they would put it, prostitution is innately wrong, so we should make it impossible for women to practice it, in the same way that they view drug use. Make it illegal and the problem will go away. How's it working in the world of pot again? Gender studies professor Darlene Joshka at the University of Regina put it like this. I think that the criminalization of everything around prostitution, except prostitution itself, means that sex workers are not positioned to seek assistance should their lives be risked. This argument strikes me as incredibly sexist and paternalistic. I know it's not a very skeptical critique, but it's not a very rational argument. With regards to the law at hand, it's also irrelevant. If you accept that prostitution is innately harmful, then your goal should be not to make brothels illegal or safe, but to make prostitution itself illegal. So that's how the old law worked, and the evidence the judges used to arrive at the decision that seems consistent with the skeptical mind. Now there are two questions to be asked. If prostitution is innately wrong, be it moral, gender equality, or other reasons, then the law should outlaw prostitution, a position I oppose, but we will save that argument for another day. It seems to be the current will of the people to see prostitution as just another trade or occupation that is not innately wrong. As such, it is currently legal in Canada. Those who disagree with this are welcome to change the minds of Canadians, with rational empirical evidence, of course, but this is a straw man argument against brothels themselves. As a society, we accept prostitution as a valid legal profession. That said, we can agree that prostitution is currently practiced can lead to situations where workers are subjugated to violence, theft, and coercion. The second question then is, how can we make the sex trade safer for participants, workers and clients, and law-abiding? The striking down of these laws was a step in that direction. The implementation of the proposed law would be two steps back. As long as prostitution is legal, and even if it weren't, there will be brothels. They are convenient for clients and desired amongst the workers. Read the testimony mentioned above. So under which condition, legal versus illegal, are brothels more likely to be a positive environment or a negative environment? If they are illegal, there is no opportunity for civic officials, be it law enforcement, medical, or social, to interact with the workers to ensure their safety and security, and of course to provide support for those who are working against their wishes. If they are illegal, they are, by definition, run by criminals. The criminal element is, by its nature, more likely to abuse its workers. It's also likely to be involved in other subsidiary illegal activities, such as drug dealing. This is dangerous not only to the workers, who will be more likely forced into conditions of dependency, but also the imminent harm to the community. If they are illegal, the workers are discouraged from working in safe neighborhoods and self-incriminate if they contact authorities to report abuse. The communication law also forces workers into isolated, unsafe environments. If they are legal and regulated, civic officials can ensure safe working environments, provide outreach for those suffering from addiction, and ensure the business operates both within the law and also pays its share of taxes. If they are legal, those operating the businesses will be businessmen, although I personally see capitalism as criminal. Currently, society does not. They will have, as all legal entrepreneurs, an interest to uphold the law, ensure they deal with their employees in a legal and fair way, and to provide an amiable environment for their clientele. They will be active, positive members of the community, paying taxes and protecting their investment. If they are legal, those workers in the brothel can call upon resources of the state to protect them from abuse, to help ensure safe and respectful work environments, and to not worry if they require assistance from the authorities that they themselves will be criminalized. Now, there are issues involved in the sex trade, notably child prostitution and human trafficking, i.e. sex slaves. These issues will not be exacerbated by the legalization of brothels. If anything, they will be hampered. If a brothel employs honest prostitutes, they will be more likely to be whistleblowers on brothels where illegal activities like child or slave labor is occurring. Making brothels legal will not make child sex legal, nor will encourage human trafficking. In fact, it will decrease the available avenues these activities will have to operate as most sex work becomes above board. But will this end substance abuse? End abuse of pimps? Sexual assault? No. And fair dinkum. I am not saying that legalizing brothels will end violence to prostitutes, magically eliminate the criminal pimp, stop human trafficking, or bring to an end child prostitution. What I am saying is that by making this prostitution / brothels legitimate, you will shed a light on the business and drive out most of the negative elements, making it more likely that workers will obtain counseling for addiction and medical attention. There will be a selective pressure promoting safe brothels because the vast majority of clients also want a safe and clean environment. Ultimately, those who claim they worry about the safety of sex workers are for the proposed new law, who lament that the old law is struck down, seems contradictory. They believe even if we legalize brothels, some will still remain underground and some will remain in the hands of violent and or criminal pimps. Even if that were true, all I can say is I don't understand how limiting the number of legit venues for prostitutes will make them safer. How is keeping brothels, all brothels, in the hands of criminal gangs helping to make them safer? No, these laws need to be struck down and a reasonable set of regulations put in their place. I suspect that this law will follow one of two courses. Either the cons will let the bill die in committee as we head into an election, or they will force it through Parliament, likely with a clarion call, either you support this bill or you're a rapist. Anyway, it will pass, with Harper knowing that it will be quickly struck down by the Supreme Court. This will illuminate the true purpose of promoting such a flawed and retrograde law. He is appealing to his base just before the 2015 election. Are we going to let him get away with this blatant pandering like he's done in the Ukraine and Zionist Jews and Big Oil? Now 2015 will be a boomerang election where the people will show that we still have all the power. We must be engaged, keep engaged. We must rally for the cause and fight the malice of this government, of the Harper government. We must get angry, stay angry, angry enough to actually vote. And most of all, never forget, 2015, there will be a reckoning. We'll be right back after this break.
Oh my, become a friend of CITR and get great discounts on Commercial Drive and in other areas at
Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, People's Co-op Bookstore, Audiopile Records, Bad Bird Media, Band Merch Canada, and the Vancouver Music Gallery.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure, that's what friends are for.
And we're back. Although most of our talk about the ills of prostitution focus on male attitudes of misogyny and sexism, there is an element of class warfare. So, to end on an economic note, let's listen to economist Richard Wolff on how class works.
The way class works in our society can best be understood if you think about how a business works. In most businesses, the people who do the work come 5 days a week, use their brains and muscles doing what the employer sets them as tasks, with the equipment and materials the employer provides. At the end of the day, they go home, and the employer keeps the fruits of their labor, which the employer then sells. And the goal of the employer is to get more money when he sells the output than it cost him to buy the tools, equipment, raw material, and hire those workers. Class is this difference between those who do the work, the overwhelming majority, and those who gather the profit into their hands. The way our society splits up the output leaves those who get the profits in the position of deciding and figuring out what to do with them. And we all live with the results of what a really tiny minority in our society decide to do with the profits everybody produces. The profits in our society are huge. When you think about 500 to 1,000 large corporations in the United States do the overwhelming bulk of the business, you realize that into the boards of directors of these companies flows a huge part of what you might call the discretionary income in this society. If these profit-earning companies decide they can make more profit by adopting a technology which has the unfortunate result of polluting the air or the water, corporations will typically do that because the profit is more important to them than the social consequences that basically they don't have to live with and they don't have to pay for. And so you'll get decisions about how to use the profit, which is a social disaster in terms of the health, mental and physical, of other people. Having a small group driven by profit gathering into their hands the discretionary funds shapes everything about the way we live. Class is one of the most repressed discourses in this country. Many Americans insist that we're all in the middle class, that if there are a handful of desperately poor people at one end and maybe a handful of desperately rich ones at the other, they're really a tiny footnote to a vast middle. This is a way of pretending that class differences, wealth, power, corporate structure, somehow aren't there or don't matter. They pretend that the issue isn't there or it doesn't matter or we all have it under control, none of which are true. The overwhelming majority of people have to go to work 5 days a week who live from the income that their work provides, and a very small minority have enough wealth to live off the wealth. The richest 10 or 20% of our country, which owns half the wealth, that's why they're the richest. They get rent on their land, they get interest on their money, they get all of these rewards, whether or not they do an ounce of labor ever. Whereas the vast mass of people can only live by their labor. This is a fundamental inequality that infuses everything about our culture. The lip service as a nation we give to equality, to democracy, to equal opportunity are radically undone by the reality of the class structure. So class is going to force you into unpleasant recognitions and confrontations with a reality that has to be changed. Foreclosure in the United States today is in fact a perfect example. Over the last 30 years, We have faced a phenomenon we never had before in the history of the United States. We have had rising real wages in America roughly from the beginning of our history up until the 1970s. If you worked hard, you got more money in your wage envelope at the end of the week. It was true for 150 years, and that's really amazing, and no other country did that. It stopped in the 1970s because of computers replacing people, because of American companies moving abroad where they could pay lower wages, because of a mass movement of women into the labor force, immigration, and we went from a country with a chronic labor shortage to a country with a chronic labor oversupply. Employers no longer had to raise wages to keep workers working, to keep them happy, to keep them employed. And as a result, the American working people went into a kind of prolonged psychic shock. Their wages weren't rising anymore. And so what they did was they turned to another source of money to realize the American dream that they had been culturally developed to hope for, to expect, to promise to their kids. They borrowed money like crazy. And the business community of the United States saw in the borrowing of the American working class a fantastic market to go after. You know, in the 1970s, at the beginning, the only people who had a credit card were wealthy people or folks on business expense accounts. Starting in the 1970s, we gave credit to the mass of Americans. Everybody gets a credit card, and everybody can go to the bank to borrow to buy a home. Mortgage debt, credit card debt explodes. It was a money-making extravaganza. We saw all the wealthy come together to get involved in this money. Building houses, lending workers at huge interest rates, the money with which to buy the new and expensively built homes. Wealthy people poured their money in to companies that built these homes, furnished these homes, decorated these homes, and you have a literal explosion of profitability. But of course, you can't keep lending to working people if their underlying economic situation isn't improving. So it was only a matter of time until the extra borrowing reached the limit of the underlying frozen, stagnant wages. That was hit in 2007. Millions of Americans could no longer afford the houses that they had borrowed to buy. And the foreclosure crisis represents the rage and anger of the wealthy class. If the underlying people they lent money to can't pay for them, they're going to take those houses back, throw those people out of their homes, and try to find another way to make money. Here's a perfect example of the profit motive creating a housing boom that becomes a bust. And that now, to recoup the money of the minority who invested in it, requires millions of people, the majority, to literally lose their homes, producing in the United States in 2010 and 2011 a society that has millions of empty homes side by side with millions of homeless people. Enormous pressure was placed on the United States government by big businesses, the businesses that produce homes, that clear land, that produce construction equipment, the businesses that produce the furniture that goes into the home. All of those companies have put enormous pressure on the government for the last 100 years to subsidize, to stimulate everything having to do with the home construction business. They asked the government to subsidize mortgages, which we've been doing in America since the 1930s. They wanted the government to help individuals buy homes because their well-being as corporations depended on selling those homes, selling the furniture, selling the equipment that dug the ground for the homes, etc. So the whole corporate structure of the United States has been geared to making money by developing the private home business in the United States. They are the ones who have made the major difference in all of this. Every house virtually bought and sold in the United States over the last 25 years, with very few exceptions, was paid for with a mortgage loan. That is, the buyer of the home goes to typically a bank and borrows the money with which to buy the house, and then has to make a long-term repayment to the bank for having borrowed that money. As a loan, it has two sides, the borrower and the lender. In our kind of capitalist economy, it is the rule that a banker has the social responsibility of properly assessing risk. If billions upon billions of dollars were lent to people who couldn't pay it back, then the culpability is at least as much on the side of the bankers who made those loans as it is on the borrowers who took them out. Borrowing vast amounts of money to buy homes took off in the 1970s and 80s and 90s. It had not happened before. So if you're going to blame the victim, you have to explain why the victim undertook these blameworthy activities just then and not, for example, in the previous 150 years. And now the most important point, which I made earlier. Starting in the 1970s, the American working class stopped getting real wage increases. So we have a desperate working class that undertook that borrowing because they had to. Because even though they became more and more productive for their employers did not raise their wages for the last 30 years. That's why they borrowed money, and that's why they borrowed too much money. And had the employers not taken advantage of the market to stop raising wages, had they simply continued to raise wages as American employers had been doing for the 150 years before the 1970s, there would not have been this explosion of borrowing, and there would not be the foreclosure crisis now. So the blame for all of this is really not to be found with the individual borrower, or for that matter, even with the individual banker. We have a system that worked in such a way as to drive the masses of people to borrow what they shouldn't, and to drive the corporate sector to invest and lend in ways they shouldn't. The fault is in a system that makes people behave in ways they all come to regret. Capitalism here worked better than it did in other countries for a long time, and it accumulated a lot of wealth. Over the last 30 years, it hasn't raised the wages the way it had for 150 years before. The confrontation with the inability of capitalism to deliver the goods was postponed by having Americans work way more hours than other people in other countries, and by having American workers take on a level of debt no working class ever anywhere had ever seen before. But we've now run out. We can't do more physical hours of work, and we can't borrow any more money because we're unable to pay what we've already borrowed. And we're now going to have to face it. And I think what we're going to see is an American working class that is now going to rediscover class and realize that they have to question a system that works this way. They're going to demand fundamental changes, and when they do, and as they do, they will rediscover the language of class, relearn it from the working people in other countries who never forgot it, and it'll re-enter the discourse and debates of American society, and probably with a vengeance.
That's all we have for this week. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, most first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 million suns. The horizon of the Milky Way cosmos is full beyond measure.
One time, ladies and gentlemen, we are live and direct.
Hey, this is Wade.
And this is DJ CJ. We're the hosts of Discarder Radio.
Here in Vancouver. Vancouver.
Here our new take on the 30-year legacy of Discarder Magazine, your Vancouver indie music monthly. Featuring hot local bands, live interviews, and good times.
Yeah!
tune in every Tuesday at 4 p.m. for your weekly dose of what's happening in print, on stage, and live on the airwaves. It's Discorder Radio.
Discorder.
On CITR.
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 101.9 FM.
101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Told this guy where I was from. He said, "Oh, Canada." Kind of laughed it off. That's funny, huh? Yeah. Come on. 1, 2, 1, 2. Mic check. 1, 2, 1.